Hey, Doc Danny here, and I just want to say thank you for listening to the PT Entrepreneur Podcast. If you want to get involved in the conversation and get your questions answered and feedback from myself and 1,500 other people within the PT Entrepreneur community, head over to Facebook and join the PT Entrepreneurs Facebook group. This is a great group for anybody that is in business or thinking about going into business for themselves and wants the support of other people like me and other practitioners out there that are entrepreneurs. So guys, thanks for listening. Enjoy this episode. So here's the question. How do physical therapists like us, who don't want to see 30 patients a day, who don't want to work home health, and have real student loans, create a career and life for ourselves that we've always dreamed about? This is the question, and this podcast is the answer. My name is Danny Matei, and welcome to the PT Entrepreneur Podcast. All right, what's up, guys? Doc Danny here with the PT Entrepreneur Podcast. And tonight is going to be a special night. I'm super excited to have these two gentlemen on. We got Doug Kajigian from Resilient Performance Systems and Kelly Storette from Mobility Wad in San Francisco CrossFit. And we're jumping on the podcast to talk about the profession of physical therapy and where we see it going and things within it that we feel like should change or not change in terms of how we standardized care, or if we should standardize care. So this might be a little bit different than what many of you that listen on a regular basis are used to. I'm not going to teach you how to get more people in the door, how to actually get them to commit to you, how to build a business, anything like that. But you have to understand, all of us that are on this podcast, first and foremost, you know, we work with human beings, right? We work with people, and people are messy. People are multifactorial. And
Stop it.
It's true. It's true. and it's something that's going to be really interesting to talk about is, you know, as a profession, where are we at in terms of, are we doing a good job of getting people better? And do we need more standardization within the practice of physical therapy? So here's what I want to do. I'm going to kick it off, and I'm just going to let Doug go with this. I think he's the one that got the most heated in the Twitter conversation that he was having. If you guys haven't seen it, go follow Doug on Twitter and check out, you know, what he's been saying about standardization within the profession. But I'm going to let him start in terms of his views on physical therapy and whether he feels like it should be more standardized than it is currently or not.
Yeah, thanks, Danny, for having me on. I guess to answer the first part of your question, there's kind of this narrative on social media, on the internet, that physical therapy is broken and the profession has to change and sort of be rescued. And, you know, a lot of times, like, people think that their problems are unique. I would imagine that most fields within medicine probably think that there are things that need to be fixed internally. So I don't think that physical therapy is unique in that regard. And I'm not one of these alarmists who's like, you know, the field of physical therapy is so broken and has to be rescued. I know for myself, you know, running my own business, like, I haven't really encountered an issue where people, I was unable to achieve whether it was a clinical outcome or a business outcome because by virtue of the fact that I'm a physical therapist. Now, people may have come from having previous experiences with other physical therapists, but they also had other experiences with different medical providers outside of physical therapy. So, and like, I'm not the arbiter of what good PT is. So I don't want to make it like, well, physical therapy is so bad that I'm one of those guys that's doing it right. I don't think that's fair. And that's a little bit self-righteous. I think like any other profession, physical therapy has, you know, more competent practitioners and less competent. And that's how much that's going to change. With regard to the standardization question, you know that I come from a background in the military that combined aviation and emergency medicine. So I appreciate standard operating procedures as much as anybody. They serve a specific purpose in a military sense, you have standard operating procedures to sort of limit constraint and limit choice. So like in emergency medicine, let's take ACLS. There's an ACLS algorithm because in an ACLS scenario, people are effectively dead. They're in cardiac arrest. And that's not the time to be using intuition to come up with a procedure to fix something. Now, in the military and in aviation, like, I parachuted in the military. I've literally been skydiving and I had a parachute that was uncontrollable and I had to refer to my emergency procedure and go through a checklist because, again, that's not the time to figure out, like, well, what should I do when my canopy is uncontrollable? But physical therapy is not emergency medicine and it's not aviation. It's not this emergent situation where if you don't make a decision very quickly, you might have a catastrophic result. So there's different degrees of when you need standardization in medicine. I look at physical therapy almost more as coaching than I do as trying to fix pathology in a medical sense, because as physical therapists, in my opinion, we're not actually addressing pathology directly. We're working around pathology to maximize function and to improve movement. So we need to be respectful of it, but I as a physical therapist, am not directly influencing pathology. So I think that you need some standardization as far as like having a, you know, common education, common licensure exam, and we already have those things. So beyond that, you know, how much standardization do we need or want? I personally value individual choice and provider discretion, and more importantly, patient value. So we're not treating people who are in ventricular fibrillation where we don't really, like, in that situation, you don't care about somebody's feelings or their goals. You're trying to change their heart rhythm so they stay alive. But if I have somebody who comes to me, it's not necessarily what I want. It's about what they want. Like, why are you here? And I always try to start backwards from somebody's goals and then just work within my scope of practice. So like there's an individualization.
Doug, let me jump in for a second. Sure. So set this up for us, because I think everything you said is, I think every physio on the planet would completely agree. So how did we get to this conversation? What, because this is, the internet is wild and Twitter is a bitter battleground for physical therapists. So we'll leave it at that. And there are some big heavy guns out there who are very strongly opinionated in our field, and I'm probably missing them, but you know, some of the big water carriers are Karen Litzy and Greg Lehman and Peter Sullivan, Sandy Hilton, for example. And these, I would say Adam Meekins is on there, although we don't follow each other anymore because we fought too much. But how did you get to this conversation? Because I now really try to say not what's happening, but why are they saying this? So when I go into any coaching environment, I see radical, brilliant coaches trying to apply their critical thinking to a unique or novel problem. And I ask, what problem are they trying to solve? And then I get less sort of sidetracked by tools, and I'm more interested in their critical thinking. So I'm trying to apply that same algorithm, which has worked for me forever. Why is this working in sport? How am I solving this movement problem or this motivation problem or pain problem? And what problem is that? So what problem do you think got the three of us together in the first place to have this conversation? Why is there a need, or why are people saying that standardization maybe even should be a thing?
Well, yeah, because I think that, you know, now with the movement more towards valuing research, you know, somebody will come out and look at a systematic review that says, for example, pick any controversial modality in PT. Like, I don't want to revisit the same old discussions, but so somebody will say, oh, the systematic review shows that such and such intervention is no good. That leads to a discussion where people say, oh, if only the profession could be standardized. And the implication there is that, well, I don't like modality X. Therefore, because I don't like it, we should standardize the profession so that people aren't doing it. And standardization then becomes a problematic thing, because to me, unless you're willing to enforce that standardization, it's really just a rhetorical plea. So then there was a thread going on where people were saying, we want more standardization. And I'm kind of like, well, what does that really mean? Because to me, standardization means, like in the military, if I deviated from a standard operating procedure, like I could be kicked off the team. There were consequences for it. So are you saying that, like, legally or professionally, if I deviate from said standard and I work with an athlete or a patient and I kind of just do what I want based on my scope of practice without following like an algorithm, that I can be removed from the profession or somehow penalized or punished? And it's like, well, no, we didn't really mean that. So then it's like kind of like, well, if you're not willing to enforce it and you actually do want people to have discretion, then you're really just kind of saying, well, I just don't like what other people do. And in a way, it can become a form of grandstanding. Now, I'm not saying that some people aren't sincere, but like any physical therapist wants the profession to be good. The question is, well, what is good? And that becomes a very tricky conversation, because who is the arbiter of good? And if we're going to have standardization, who is the arbiter of what we're actually going to do? Who is the arbiter of what tests we're going to use? Because even if we say, okay, we're going to use, most people agree that like exercise is good. It's not as controversial as manual therapy or some of these other things. Well, what does exercise even mean, right? Because you can go to 10 different physical therapists. They're all going to do Ferrex or exercise, but it's not going to look the same. Now, I don't think that's a bad thing. Some people do, but if you went to a track coach and you wanted to get faster, like they're not all going to do the exact same program. If you're training on the 100 meters, they're all going to do things that resemble acceleration and maximal velocity based training. And maybe there are some bad coaches who are going to have people running 10 miles to get better in the 100, but that stuff kind of sorts itself out in the marketplace. So as long as people aren't being dangerous, to me, I think individual discretion is a good thing. But
so do you think that this is a more of a recent phenomenon of the internet is allowing us to suddenly peer into each other's practice, and that this, like you say, will normalize as we start to see who's really getting good results? Because I think, not only were you saying the intervention, the conversation started around interventional kind of thinking. And you did bring up an excellent point, which I call it's the physical therapy zombie argument, right? We're just like, oh, here we go, talking about valgus knee again, or rounded backs, or SAFE, or, X and such, or we didn't talk about pain or recognize pain in the brain. Or there's just definitely some zombies that you can virtual signal like that, right? The virtual signaling is very strong. But do you think that maybe have come out of a conversation that I know you and I run into, and I know you do too, Danny, where I have run into a patient who has been given really disenfranchising information. They have been told that they have a slipped disc, quote unquote, that they should be afraid of any flexion movement for the rest of their life. They haven't sort of been given a notion of unconditional positive regard and how robust their systems are. Do you think that is what this is really a stem from, that we're seeing that some physical therapists out there are we're running in and doing a lot of cleanup? Because I think underneath this is something that there's a neuro physician out of Australia who's a good friend of mine, and I think it's like Libretto 77. It's his handle, and he likes to take on the fact, because he's coming at it from as a physician, seeing people with pathologies that are really require some surgical intervention. And he makes a really good point. I don't think he's very popular among the physical therapists, but he is a lifter, and has a movement-based rehab center in his hospital. So he gets people moving again and sees that a lot of the problems, he's come to believe that a lot of problems he sees are movement dysfunctions. But his point is, how do we know if a physical therapy has failed? And I think part of this scope of conversation is, how do we know if someone has gone through their 10 visits or hasn't met their goals? I mean, if we're talking about standardization, we have to know when physical therapy hasn't worked or when people have dropped off. And right now, let me ask you, Danny, what is your mechanism of reporting if physical therapy doesn't work?
It's so subjective, right? I think for us, one of the things that we want to see is if we see non-progression for us, honestly, within 3 visits, we're usually really quick at getting somebody progress that we want to see. And if we don't, then that's obviously where we see, all right, well, we may need to get this to the next level of care, wherever that might be, to get an opinion on if we're missing something in particular systemic, right? And I think this is where we fit. This is where I learned where I fit in the military, because most people that we saw came in and it was non-referral. Almost all of it was direct access, right? So within that continuum, we have to understand where we are within our own kind of skill set and where it may be something more significant. But that being said, people are, like I said, very multifactorial, right? So you can have somebody, for instance, that is dealing with something that's very chronic and is depressed, right? And is going through something very difficult. And all of a sudden, maybe we're not the right fit for them. They need to talk to somebody that's a psychologist, behavioral health specialist, whoever it might be. All of a sudden they come back, things are feeling significantly better, and they've done nothing else besides get help from a mental standpoint. And then we can work on some of the physical things if they're even still there at that point. So for us, it's really hard to say. I'm not quite sure we can standardize that. We just know that, if we see somebody for a couple of visits and symptoms are not changing the way that we want, then we need to get some of our, we call it our dream team involved, which are really strong providers that we vetted throughout the city that we'll send people to directly, that we have communication with. So we have this sort of symbiotic relationship to see where they're at.
So, because I think Doug, and I, you and I have known each other a long time. I think I knew you even before you were a physio.
Yep.
And, and I've known you, Danny, for a long time. And I both know how you practice, and I both know the communities that you're in. Because I bump into the same communities. I'm at Altus, you're at Altus. We see each other. So if we're going to take the standardization question out, one of the things that I want our profession to be good at is to say, this didn't work here. And no one talks about that, which for me is one of the roots of, I think, what you're frustrated around, Doug, is that there is zero transparency in how people, and especially the people who are virtual signaling or saying we should standardize. I can't, for the life of me, see what a session looks like for them. I don't have no idea who they see, the populations they see, the volume of patients they see, the complication of the patients they see, the variety of cohorts. So you're saying that this may work for a untrained, middle-aged woman who, you know, has some non-specific low back pain, not exercising, and going through divorce. Okay, great. I'm going to go talk to the NFL. I'm going to go talk to these soldiers, and they only have one physical therapist for 5,000 people. I'm trying to deal with this school. And all of a sudden, even that standardization at that moment doesn't even fit the practice of the patient. So I'm really one of the hallmarks, I think, of what we've got to do as a next generation physical therapist is continue to be so transparent about this was a failure and talking about it. Because to your point, Doug, you know, if you're saying let's standardize, then we need to have this conversation out to the period. What does that mean? How many sessions should you get if someone has a raging hot shoulder from impingement from doing crappy pull-ups and muscle-ups, right? If someone's heel striking and is, I mean, how are you managing? And if you lay over, I think one of the classic sort of type one errors on this is how many times a week are you actually seeing a patient? And for how long? Are you seeing them once every 2 weeks and your eval was 30 minutes and your follow-up was 15 minutes and you shelved them off? Or are you like Kaiser where I got a 45-minute eval, but it took me 3 to 6 weeks to get you back in for a follow-up that lasted 30 minutes? And then I handed you some sheets with some stick figures saying 3 sets of 10 with zero follow-up and zero connection and zero accountability. So, I mean, the thing that I see on the internet, I think, that drives us crazy is like, okay, we appreciate that we should be letting people know that this is a great practice model or this technique success. But what I'm getting is I'm being shouted at from the virtue signalers who may not even talking to me, but I'm pretending that they're talking to me. And again, I've been the object of their opprobrium. I mean, just, you can go out into the internet and watch some of these physical therapists trash me publicly on some of their talks. And I'll say that, boy, that doesn't show me what you did, how you did it, when you did it. What you just said is I don't like how he did it, right? And I think that's the key. So outcomes are important. How are we tracking outcomes? You know, how do we know if something was a success and how long it took? And should we reproduce that? Because I think this critical thinking model is, to your point, Doug, that at the very heart of this, I need a critical thinker who is an independent person who can say, this is beyond me, and I'm going to solve this problem uniquely for this person, which is, to your point, coaching.
Yeah, and there's a lot there. The first is, I would say that, like, as an individual therapist, I don't feel compelled to justify what I do to other therapists. Like, I don't treat to impress people on Twitter. Like, I'm trying to get an outcome.
Oh, whatever.
In front of me.
You're all about the follows, bro.
Right. Yeah. But a lot of this stuff is driven by systemic constraints too, because in the insurance-based model, I'm like, look, I'm a realist about what the system is, but most physical therapy tends to be in network with insurance companies. So if you know, as an example, that you're going to get 10 visits authorized for non-specific low back pain, like, there often isn't a lot of incentive to discharge people before those 10 visits. Especially
right.
If the reimbursement is not very good.
Type one error. You nailed it. Okay, so let's circle that. We'll come back to that, or someone needs to put that on our problem list, right? Here's our symptoms, irritability, nature, right? And that's one. So okay, keep going. Because that's a big deal.
It's huge because, I mean, I think that a lot of times, because people have this perception that healthcare is free, even though it's not really free, that there isn't a lot of incentive to innovate. And I think in a way the field is almost too standardized, in my opinion, because the experiences that I've had with patients who have had other experience with physical therapy, like, yeah, I did the same thing everywhere. So I'm actually seeing the opposite problem where people are doing the same thing and it tends to be very generic. And I understand that in these clinics, they're working under the constraint of low reimbursement. So they have to run volume-based models. And so the people who are coming in with back pain are going to do the back exercise sheet. So in some ways, like, the cash-based model is a little bit more honest and is more conducive to innovation and really driving, letting the patient be the arbiter of what good treatment is. Because if they're willing to pay for it, right, that's to a degree makes it, and it's not perfect, but it's, to a degree it makes it somewhat a decent product. And then people have a finite amount of money and time. So when their insurance company is not paying for those 10 visits, it's like, look, I can't spend X number of dollars per hour out of pocket for this. So like, if you can't do this, get me a good result and put me in a home program that I can do on my own in 1 to 2 visits. Like, we have this expectation that, and I get that, you know, there are people who are like coming off an ACL surgery and they're not getting authorized enough visits. I'm not talking about a post-op scenario. I'm talking about like, you know, your knee hurts going up and down the stairs, no trauma, that kind of stuff. And people will complain like, oh, I was only authorized X number of visits. Well, what if someone gave you 1 visit or 2 visits for non-specific low back pain? Like, do you have resources in place, whether it's like YouTube videos, online progressions, things that they're not required to do things with you every second of the day? Because if I went to the dentist and the dentist said, you've got to come in 3 days a week for the next 8 weeks, I'd be like, you're out of your mind. Like, I don't have time for that. Even if it's free, like, I don't want to go to the dentist 3 days a week. Like, just because I do physical therapy as a career and I'm passionate about it doesn't mean that I expect everyone else to care what I do in this room here. So I think sometimes, you know, incentives can drive good behavior and innovation. And I don't think that the healthcare system really allows for that right now. So a lot of this stuff is very constraints driven. And it's not just a matter of like on a micro level, what's going on. There's other things that affect it for sure.
Well, I think you bring up a really interesting point in terms of, you know, we've seen it from both sides, all of us, right? The insurance-based side, the cash-based side, where we have more time with people. Not only that, they're more pot committed because they've got skin in the game, and they're actively seeking out what they consider probably a little bit different of a resource. But the standardization, you're right, dude, constantly. People come in to see us for pretty much anything under the sun, and they've already tried physical therapy in most cases. Very rarely does somebody come to us directly that hasn't seen physical therapy. And I can tell you the same 7 shoulder exercises they're probably doing for, you know, impingement. And then they come see us, and yet no one's ever watched them do a pull-up. No one's ever watched them press or do a push-up. And then all of a sudden, we apply this idea of the movement side of things in conjunction with some of these ancillary things they probably do need to do. And all of a sudden, their symptoms are resolved and they're back to the thing that they want to do, right? So, you know, I think the inherent issue primarily, and this is obviously I'm very passionate about the idea of limiting the utilization of insurance. I think it's not good for the consumer. I think it's only good for the company. I think it drives PT mills to have these high volumes in order to maintain profitability. Most of them are owned by private equity. I get it, right? It's it is what it is. It's a business. But the reality is they're treating they're treating the lowest common denominator, the Medicare and work comp population that who knows if they actually want to get better, right? They have a 2-year long ankle sprain because they're in litigation. And now you're talking about how does that get applied to these systemized approaches? Like, how long should that take, right? How long should an ankle sprain take if somebody falls off a cell phone tower and doesn't want to go back to work? Like, I remember that early on when I was a student. That's one of the first ankle sprains I ever saw. I was like, this guy's here for a year. It's because he doesn't want to go back and climbing cell phone towers. He almost died. So like, how does that get rolled into this? And the other big thing is, I mean, I remember when I was at Baylor, John Childs was my research director. And this is right when clinical prediction rules were getting implemented significantly. And I remember seeing patients for back pain issues utilizing these clinical prediction rules and thinking to myself, okay, this person has to do traction. Like, I never thought one bit about, what's this guy's home life like? You know, like, okay, yeah, he's carrying a bunch of gear around. He's in the army, but like, it says he has got sciatica style symptoms. He needs to do traction. This is the clinical prediction rule. And I can tell you within about 6 months of graduating and utilizing that ineffectively in many ways, I started looking for other options. And this is honestly how I started getting into a lot of Kelly stuff, going down the rabbit hole of YouTube. And I was like, oh shit, yeah, I got to watch a move. That makes sense. So I think we've tried some of that before. And I don't know if you guys still use clinical prediction rules. I highly doubt it. But I don't know many really high-level clinicians that use clinical prediction rules still and are effective for the large population. Maybe a small sliver of people that works for. But I just don't know if you can standardize it. I don't know. Kelly, have you ever used clinical prediction rules?
Are you talking about like Ottawa rules and red flags every day, son?
Never.
And, you know, I'll tell you, I've had my mind blown off about standard of care. So, yeah. I thought about the diathermy I was responsible for in physical therapy school, or the paraffin bath I was responsible for in therapy school, or the understanding the hydrocolator temperature, things that were never there. We weren't allowed to plug these things in. Are those still things on the practice? I don't know. You know, what I'll tell you is that I came up and was taught to ice. This was what everyone was doing. Well, guess what? There's no research to support that at all. So if you're, you know, in fact, there's a lot of research to show that icing makes things worse. So, you know, one of the things that I began to realize was that, you know, some of these rules where, you know, if I did a sideline shear test, all I was doing was confirming what I already saw when I saw someone squat, which is where they had a super wiggly segment and they didn't have any control to do that. And I think what's interesting is, you know, as we kind of feel our way through this, you know, if what we can never do as a profession is ever write within normal limits again, right? What we need to write is, I'm not assessing this. It's not in my problem list. I won't get reimbursed for this. Okay, I'll accept that. But also, there is this continuum that we feel like you have to be accountable for, which is children, recreational athletes, all the way up to the Olympians, and so you have to be able to account for your thinking and all of that stuff. And if there doesn't scale or doesn't account for an age group or a cohort, there's somewhere that you've got some dissonance in your thinking. And one of the things that we saw, you know, with the icing, for example, is that we stopped icing and started decongesting. And man, we were ahead of swelling within 12 hours after ACL reconstruction. No swelling in 12 hours, total neuromuscular control, full extension. I was like, okay, so what do I do for the first 3 weeks, you know? And if that's the case, you know, where is the place? What's the mechanism for this innovation in there? And then B, where is the place where we can begin to have a greater scope of conversation of recognizing that these clinical predictors are useful for helping me? That's a tertiary output of a of an algorithm that helps me make better choices, but shouldn't be a defined dead end, right? Like I start to see, I mean, how many times did you hear this in physio school, Doug? Like expert clinicianship is ultimately about pattern recognition and expert level pattern recognition. And, you know, one of the things that happened, I think is unique about all our experiences is that I didn't see one patient every hour or 10 patients a day I suddenly had 400 athletes in my gym 4 to 5 times a week. I was going around and seeing such large patterns that I was seeing that induction, but I was recognizing it for what it was and usually seeing that there was a movement related issue to it. But I get where this is coming from, you know? And I think we always can be having a better conversation about the language that we use, about, you know, not fear mongering. I agree with that 100%, but there is a whole bunch of just piousness on the internet where, you know, I don't see people. I think Sandy Hilton or Sarah Hegg just put out a book, which is one of the first books out of this group. I'm thrilled on that she's writing a book about her pelvic floor model because, you know, show us what's working for you, not what this N of 10 small research piece did, because I really feel like it doesn't fit in with the people that I'm seeing and how it works. So there's definitely a mismatch. And if right now today, you had to say, are you a physical therapist? I'd be like, well, according to the internet, I'm not, you know? And my wife, who's a CEO, you know, but she was trained as an attorney. Is she an attorney? She's not practicing as an attorney, but she certainly uses attorney skills. So is there a time and case for, you know, this specialization? But why can't you speak to all these cohorts? Because we see a lot of things in our gym clinic, just like everyone else does, but we're always relating it back to function and capacity. So we come back to this within normal limits idea. And I say, well, how do you define normal limits? Because I had to memorize all the joint ranges of motion. I think you did too. And how is that expressed in movement? Because that's the thing, right? Not can I passively assess you on the table? That's my confirmation. The thing that matters most is not, you know, how I grade you as you roll out of bed, but can you fucking get out of bed by yourself and walk around independently, comma, that's pretty low level. Ultimately, do you have full range of motion in your hip? And is that a component? And how are we assessing that? Not do you have the components to function, but do you actually have the function? And I think we have done, and I'm just going to swear here, sweet fuck all around helping people understand what is normal and what's not normal. And by that, I mean normative. I mean full. I mean the thing that we all agree on is full range of motion in the shoulder joint, not, hey, everyone's a unique snowflake and every compensation is just a unique solution to a novel movement problem. Like, that's horseshit. And otherwise, if we apply that thinking out, it doesn't work. We teach kids to swing a tennis racket a certain way. We teach batters to sit a certain way. Like, we teach technique to people. Somehow with movement, it doesn't seem to matter.
Yeah, and to piggyback on that, and Danny, like, to your point, your question, I'm not opposed to clinical prediction rules or protocols. I think they do serve as a good guide from which you can deviate. It's kind of like the saying, like, all models are wrong, but some are useful. It's like, just know the limitation of the model. I look at it a lot like periodization. People are like, oh, well, periodization isn't really a thing. But, like, yeah, I mean, it's good to learn about linear periodization and block periodization. But what I'm opposed to is compelling that somebody purely adhere to a block periodization model without looking at individual factors. I'm opposed to compelling people to adhere to a clinical prediction rule. So I'm saying you can have all these things, but it's actually not, and it's a definitional issue. I don't consider it standardization until it has teeth, until you say, look, if you don't do this, then you're not a part of the profession. And no one's trying to actually say that. So,
aren't we at odds with this complex biopsychosocial model that we are complex psychoemotional beings? And does that clinical prediction model work when that person is going through a divorce, is an alcoholic, refuses to move, sits all day, is sedentary? And at what point, who is responsible for that? And, you know, giving someone a sheet or passing, just, you know, hey, by the way, this is probably in your brain. It's not really in your back and you're just stressed. That's not helpful. But I'll tell you, we're going to have to reconcile that dissonance, exactly what you're saying around, you know, if we want to give credence to the fact that people are in different phases in their life. And by the way, this is the core tenet of being a coach, actually working with athletes trying to do something. How do you feel today? What's going on? How are we managing your volume? Hey, do you, looks like you're fried. I mean, we don't have any of those conversations. I don't think our profession is set up to have that conversation with people, talk about nutrition, talk about sleep, hygiene, talk, you know, we don't. We just say, hey, look, here's a book. I don't know what to tell you, but, you know, this manual therapy isn't going to help you, right? And, you know, and so how are we going to reconcile these clinical prediction models, which is a form of specialization, and the fact that everyone who walks in is slightly different is a snowflake? You know, tell me, how do we solve that?
Yeah, and the difference is, like, if people want to use clinical prediction rules, like, I'm not telling anybody not to. The difference is there are people who are telling me that if I don't want to do what they're doing, then I'm doing it wrong. And I'm not telling anybody they're doing it wrong. Like, there's a lot of ways to get a good result with a patient. And like I said, I'm not the arbiter of that. But I think there are some people where it's like, when they say standardization, unless they're really willing to enforce it, what you're effectively saying is, if you're not doing it my way, then you're wrong, which, there's always a fine line between activism and self-righteousness. And I'm not, like, in some way, in some aspects, they could be right about certain things, but there's a fine line where, you know, if you're not willing to be totally transparent, and because if we speak in abstracts, like, we can agree on most things, even people who maybe don't practice on a practical level like we do. But when it comes down to, like, all right, well, what does this standardization actually look like? Then I've got to see an interaction with the patient in a case study. And until people...
No, I need to see like 10 of those.
Sure.
10.
I'd be happy with one, right? But it's like, what are... Just even thought process, like, what do you do? What did you do with this one person? And assuming that, like, HIPAA was complied with, like, all right, like, film a treatment session, because these abstracts are meaningless until we actually see how this is applied. It's the application. Again, in theory, most people can agree on these things, but it's like, what do you actually do? This is not... It's not a research paper. This is like an actual patient encounter.
Yeah, you know, Adam Meekins made a really good point in a publication that, obviously, he's really good at pointing out our fallacies and our holes in our thinking. Like, you know, physical therapy would be worse off if we didn't have someone like Adam Meekins, who detests me. And what I'll say is, I'm so grateful for his critical eye, because what I every time he throws an internet fit, what I think to myself is, oh, I'm sure he has a point here. You know, I think how he delivers it is sometimes less good, and he really shuts off a lot of people who could, you know, who could benefit from his thinking and benefit from his rationalization. But one of the things he's saying is, you know, hey, manual therapy is terrible for low back pain, for chronic back pain. And one of the things that I, you know, they're not a fan of that. It's hard to standardize that. And I was like, well, I think manual therapy is a real tool. You know, it's not my go-to tool. And then I thought about people who have chronic low back pain in my clinic, and I don't use any manual therapy on them. And so I was like, okay, well, wait a minute. Why am I defending manual therapy? What am I doing to make someone feel better or have some input at home or teaching technique? But the first thing we do is teach movement and breathing, talk about how resilient they are and how they're going to. And I was like, okay, so I think I'm 100% in line with his thinking. But to your point around, I still haven't seen how he treats. And I haven't been to one of his courses, and I'd really like to. But that's still not the same thing as coming in and watching start to finish, soup to nuts, how someone is handling these things. And what point do you discharge? What point do you, what are they doing? Intercession change, Danny, is something that we've obsessed about. Yeah. And, you know, and if we're talking about chronic low back pain, I can see how total hip range of motion matters less. But if we're talking about your low back pumps out and you don't have any hip extension and you're a Games athlete, that's a problem. So I can see how suddenly we're talking past each other around this standardization idea. You know, one of the things I think we forget as physios, as we move this chain, as you're talking about, is the result of physiology. So, you know, I was talking with Sean McBride at our gym just about this conversation, the standardization, and he was like, man, I came out of a generation of physical therapists who rejected every modality out of hand. We're like, screw it. We don't use modalities. Modalities are not the same thing as coaching, teaching, touching, right? Reinforcing, giving input in. And I think we missed the opportunity on a couple things. There's some, you know, maybe some of the stuff is on the edge of valid, and some of the things. So movement is a big deal. So I have a neighbor who had a flaming hot elbow, and he doesn't play tennis and he doesn't golf. So I don't know what it was, some kind of itis of his elbow that had been going on for months. So obviously it's not an itis, but he's in considerable pain, and he's talking about surgery, and I can tell it's bad because he's finally asked for help. And I said, hey, here's things I'm doing. You'll be okay. But first of all, let's control just fluids in and out. Like, you know, so I got him a Mark Pro, and all I had him do was pump, which is the same thing as wiggling your hands. So you have shoulder surgery and you squeeze the ball. That's the same thing. So he was able to do that for 2.5 hours, and he woke up the next day and his pain was 1 out of 10. So what's the mechanism there? Was it a conversation? Is that placebo effect? Did I decongest? You know, and my,
who cares what the mechanism is, really, you know,
that's my point. My point is I would discharge him. He's like, I'm good. I've solved this. It'll go away now. So when is physical therapy successful? When is it not successful? I didn't do a manual therapy, scraping, tooling, massage, voodoo. I didn't do any of that. We just had him move more, but passively move. He just lay there and flex his arms, right? And so how are we thinking about, because I think one of the things that came up with this conversation that happened tangentially with the conversation about the British Journal of Medicine talking about this IT standardization of IT band practice was that may have been the kernel of this. But what I saw was a bunch of things that I would have never done for IT band syndrome and have never done for IT band syndrome. And that was the practice care. And I was like, wow, I wonder why my people get better, even though I don't do the standard practice of care, and why I usually see them less than 2 or 3 visits for this. And I don't get it. How is there such ships in the night around this? So that's why. And I think to the heart, what you just said, at some point we're going to have to say, look, here's what's working. Come on over here. Instead of shouting at the model, I'll never change your practice, but I'll show you that if my practice was more effective or got better results faster or saved your hands and had happier patients who came back, or I got rich, and you might come over and be interested in what I'm doing, right? That's the Buckminster Fuller model.
Well, I think the other important thing to keep in mind is that there's so many ways to help people, right? And you can make a strong case that in manual therapy, in many cases, we're essentially just proving to somebody that we understand how to manipulate pain in a way to gain buy-in, to gain trust, and then move on to these things that we know are really going to create long-term positive changes, right? Like, in my opinion, I look at manual therapy in that way a lot. Like, they're coming in, they're vulnerable, they've seen all these other people, maybe they've had years and years of issues going on, and all of a sudden, if I can, with a test, retest, intra-session change, show like all of a sudden, oh man, like my forward bend is like half as painful. Cool. Now you're going to do the homework that I know is uncomfortable that I'm going to teach you how to do. So sure. Is this the science add up? I don't fucking know. But I tell you this much, we get a lot of people better that go a lot of other places, and they're thankful that they came to see us. So I don't really care. So when you look at standardization, though, I think that the one variable that I don't know if you can dispute this fact that is, unless it's something just random like your neighbor, is that most of these things that we see, we can draw back to some sort of movement issue associated with that, right? How many people have you seen for elbow issues that are tennis related elbow issues, and people just, they'll needle their elbow. They show them all these different exercises to do, but yet they never talk about their swing or get somebody to look at their swing that actually knows what the hell is going on. So if we look at standardization, there needs to be a strong, compelling element for movement associated with that. Because I think if it's not, I didn't learn this stuff in school. I don't know. I'm sure you guys didn't either. Like my first strong kind of element of movement analysis came from delving into to Kelly, to your stuff, like early on. And then all of a sudden I was like, dude, I'm missing the boat on all this stuff that we didn't learn in school. So if that's the case, then I think as a bigger question, it's probably, what are we not learning that we probably should learn that can make our profession better? Instead of standardization, what are some key elements that we just are missing? And I think movement, and I'm sure you too, Doug, knowing your background, like a lot of what you do, it doesn't really look like conservative physical therapy. And in many cases, I don't know if you guys feel this way, but I don't feel like I fit in with my peers who are other physical therapists. I seem to get along better and fit more in coaching environments, strength and conditioning environments. So I'm not quite sure where we fit, but I don't know if it's physical therapy as much as it is this hybrid kind of approach.
Well, yeah, 2 points. The first is a lot of the people who are calling for the standardization, it's conjecture. If you watch what they actually did relative to the people that they're critical of, they're probably pretty much doing the exact same things. The difference is the critical people maybe have more robust theoretical explanations for what they're doing.
Yeah.
So to me, the workaround for this is, okay, like most of what we do, we really don't know how it works. So let's just not speculate about why what we're doing is working or not working, and just say, look, like as far as I know, this is safe. A lot of what we're doing is trial and error, test, retest. We're going to try this and see if we get the result that we want. If not, we're going to do something else. So, you know, in this way, you don't have to say, well, we're decreasing ion channel sensitivity, or we're, you know, sensitizing the nervous system, or breaking up scar tissue. You don't need to say any of those things. Just say, like, you want to get to point, you know, point B, you're at point A, we're going to try to systematically get you there, and we're not going to speculate unless you really, really want that kind of information. Then I'll give you stuff to read, because that's not why we're here to go over that. So that's the first point. The second one is, I mean, there are a lot of problems that I encounter in the clinic where, like you said, I didn't get the answers anywhere in my formal PT education. So perfect example, today I was working with a high school sprinter. He's a senior. He's being recruited by some high-level D1 schools. He had a grade 2 hamstring tear 2 months ago, and he's been going to other providers, orthos, physios. He hasn't done anything that's resembled running in 2 months, nothing. The most aggressive thing that he's done is lift, which lifting is great, but that's not going to get you ready for sprinting. His season starts in 2 weeks, and he's had multiple medical providers tell him, I think you should skip your entire season. For a grade 2 hamstring strain that he has no pain at rest, on the table, he looks fine. So today what we did was stuff that I learned from Altus, Derek Hansen. It's basically sprint progressions. So it looked more like a track practice than it did a physio session. But if I had done whatever the professional standard is, it's hoping that we do something totally tangential to his goal, and that that by luck, it works out that he can run again. Coming from the military background, like, I don't believe in luck. I believe in preparation and not, you know, no false confidence. So like, all right, if you've got a sprint at max velocity, we're not going to do that today for the first time in 2 months, but we're going to do, you know, resisted acceleration. We're going to do tempo runs. We're going to work on mechanics. We're going to work on, make sure you don't overstride and put more stress on your hamstring eccentrically. But these are things that were not part of physio education. But if the job is to solve problems, then you've got to go to whoever is going to help you solve the problem. And so that's where the standardization thing can be problematic, because who in physical therapy is the arbiter of sprint progressions, right?
Problematic. Show me the research that show that your tempo run foot contact cue was effective at this dose, at this stage, after 2 months of being a high school athlete eating Cheetos and laying on the bed. And I mean, it doesn't work. So that argument is specious, and it completely falls apart under any examination, to your point. Right. You know, and so, you know, I ironically, I'll see a sprinter tomorrow at a high school. He's the best sprinter in the school. He's been dealing with this hamstring thing for 18 months. No one's gone out. So guess what? I'm like, well, hey, do you have any hip range of motion? I'm not going to look at your hamstring. Let's just talk first. You know, and the kid is trying to do the right thing. He's got a great coach. He has his hip locks at about 88 degrees, 85 degrees, conk. And it's not a bony end feel. It's just stiff.
Right.
And what you can see is, boy, in the primary engine where that hamstring is crossing, you don't even have full range of motion. So where does looking at hip range of motion fit in to this sequela of issues, right? You know, where does the conversation about warming up before you play tennis, Danny, fit in? Or cool down fit in? Where are – I didn't learn those protocols, and I don't really know what the standardization protocol is for those things.
Yeah, I mean, how do you do that? It's such an infinite amount of things that could be causing be the root cause of a problem. Let's put it that way, because in most cases, the things that we're learning are symptomatic. Like, for instance, like I remember treating somebody via the clinical prediction rule for referral, you know, pain down the leg for back pain, put them on traction machine, feels better, goes back out, deadlifts like a douchebag, comes back in, and go figure, his back is hurt again. So it took me realizing, oh crap, we're totally missing out on this element of what is probably causing you symptoms to begin with, because I'm blinded by this idea of this clinical prediction rule that says you're supposed to do traction and in like 4 weeks, this is going to be better. But yet we really don't resolve the root cause of the issue. So I think it gets really challenging. And the other thing is research. I think we can all agree, and I'm not trying to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but like research can be very biased. You know, I've been involved in a lot of research at Baylor, and these are big projects with a lot of money behind it. And I've gotten into SPSS with instructors and thought to myself, how in the fuck are you manipulating this to actually find something? It looks like this is basically, you know, no result or the same. And all of a sudden we find something that's barely statistically significant. And now all of a sudden they've got a publication. So I think that inherently research is somewhat biased. You can say that it's not, but when you have a bunch of money and time behind it, look, you don't want to waste your time in the process. And it depends where it's being done, who's backing it, all kinds of things. So I'm not quite sure that you can just bank on the fact that research is going to tell you the right thing. Not only that, how often do you see research that just disproves other research constantly? So
So you talked about being at Baylor, incredible work going on there, and they're pretty transparent about some of the innovation and things they do, which is one of the hallmarks of that. But to your point, Doug, if we're talking about specialization through, how is it that I have a school that comes out? So my physio school was Samuel Merritt University. At the time, we had heavy-duty manual clinical therapists. Everyone was a superstar. Right out of Kaiser Vallejo, right out of that PNF program, we had NDT specialists. We had musculoskeletal experts from Kaiser all the time. As integrated, I think, as an excellent as education as I could get, and yet what I've heard from the internet is that my rationale and the theory through the entire school was actually bullshit. And actually that rationale and way of critical thinking didn't fit anything. And Doug, I think you got a patient in like 5 minutes, don't you? So
lowering the music in the gym.
Okay. So yeah. What I think is, boy, aren't we going to have a conversation even about standardization at the physical therapy school? I mean, I think we're all teaching to this test, theoretically, can we pass the board exam? But I spent a weekend studying for the board exam. It just wasn't a big deal. I was well prepared. I spent a weekend. I passed the...
You had kids too, didn't you? You had a fucking business and kids.
Juliet was looking at me in the background. She's like, you're such a jerk. My point is, that wasn't already helping me solve the issues, and the school did a good enough job to prepare me for that. Is that validation school? So the schools are all accredited, and what I'll tell you is that the staff at the time, you know, including our dean Terry Nordstrom, you know, was heavily involved in the APTA, really advocating for physical therapists. And is that a standardization issue there, Doug? I mean, you and I went to different schools, so we're going to have different biases. What if you came to some McKenzie school in Texas? What if, you know, we have therapists, students who come and do these little in-services with us or little blocks of time, and they haven't done anything. And now they're actually at UCSF making like things like ortho or understanding mechanics is an elective. So people aren't even being trained as generalists anymore in physical therapy school. So I think we have some real issues we're going to have to think about as a profession. What does it mean to be a physical therapist? How do we define that? And what is best practice? And is best practice different than specialization? Because what I do is I go, whoa, this person is getting crazy results. You know, you and I have been to Altus, Dougie, and you see their therapists are 10 feet from the track and their Olympic sprinters run and then they come over and they change something and they run again. I mean, it's that close conjoined between performance and restoration or improvement of mechanics. So, you know, where are we?
Yeah, I don't know how conducive physical therapy is to the kind of standardization that some people are calling for. It's not like treating a lethal heart rhythm where like that's the only thing you care about. Like, because if you're treating pathology, you want to fix the pathology. Because we're not treating pathology directly and we're treating function and, you know, basically trying to get someone to achieve their functional goals, that involves so much discretion where at best, all we can, I think, do is standardize concepts that we think are important. So like progressive overload, I think, is a concept that pretty much anybody can agree on. But then the more you try to like narrow that down into, well, a concrete recommendation, it becomes problematic. So I'm actually okay with it the way that it is. Just whatever, you know, the curriculum needs to be, get people to pass the boards. And as long as they're safe and not violating scope of practice, like, I don't think variation in treatment is necessarily a terrible thing. And with the right incentives in the marketplace and the healthcare system, I think that that'll drive innovation and improvement. But like, if I was in a profession where they said you have to practice this way and follow algorithms and clinical prediction rules, I don't think I'd want to do it. I'd do something else, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds, boring, right? Like it sounds, like too much structure, and all three of us have our own businesses and we sort of thrive in these situations where, I mean, Doug and I, it's interesting. We both spent time in the military where there's a lot of structure, right? And I don't know about you, but I kind of figure out how to do my own thing within those borders of the structure that I was given, and I enjoyed in many ways my jobs where I had more autonomy within the military versus when I was like stuck in a staff, you know, clinic. But, you know, this idea of having the creativity to do things, or, you know, I mean, just talk to people differently, right? I mean, like, I had a mentor that people would like break down on this guy because he was like very stern. And when they would cry, he would just leave and walk out of the office until they were done. And I thought to myself, I was like, this is a weird human being. This is fucking crazy. This person is like crying in your office and you just leave. And you leave me in there who's like 20 years old. I'm still in school. And I'm talking to them about, that's going to be okay. You know, it's like, and like, that, what the fuck do you standardize with that? Like how to not be an asshole? Like there's a lot of things that would be challenging. And I think that, you know, the fact that we have the autonomy to figure things out the way we want, it's what makes the field exciting as well. And it allows us to have creativity within it. Because I do think this, if it was just like, you know, I don't know, my brother's in emergency medicine. It's like, okay, if somebody has this, this, and this, they get this test, they get this medicine, and they memorize these things. And that sounds incredibly boring to me, honestly.
Yeah, and, you know, I just jump in and say, you know, I think our standing operating procedures and guidelines are tissue healing times, right? I understand what phase of the injury person someone's in. I understand, you know, when a physician hands me a protocol, you know, they're not trying to constrain me. They're like, dude, don't pull this repair out. Yeah. I'm trying to limit this. And I'm like, okay, so all this. So it really helps to have the boxes of understanding what the function is, and really coming back to what you're saying is, you know, what is the goal? So, you know, I think you start with Doug is like, what's the patient goal? And if that goal is just to be out of pain, then that looks very different than, you know, telling me that what I'm doing is wrong when my guy just snatched the American record and wasn't pressurizing, or I'm trying to manage a team and improve a team like the All Blacks. And at some point, you know, we try to be transparent in who we're working with. And again, I don't think it's always about me. I think we can continue to support and show people other models of understanding, but we're pretty transparent about how we get there. And it's not a gimmick. You know, it's, you know, these are our, and in our level two courses, you know, Danny, we have clear guidelines for what we think is full movement capacity, not within normal limits, not a movement screen. And those things may not ever be important to you, but if you are missing your overhead range of motion and you have excellent compensation strategies and you're a swimmer and you have shoulder impingement, I can come up with a rationale for that mechanical dysfunction, right? And I understand that you're able to buffer it when you were well-rested and well-loved and were having sex and eating like a ninja and had good life support. But as soon as one of those things went by, boom, your problem came up to the surface. So, you know, there is a lot to cover. I think I saw a great book, just finished a book called The Short History of Everyone Who Ever Lived. It's about sort of the current look of genetics by Adam Rutherford. And there's a quote in there that says, for every complex problem, there is an equally simple, elegant, straightforward solution that is wrong. And I think, you know, that really is what I think to the heart of what you're saying, Doug, is that if the brain is the most sophisticated structure in the known universe, most complex thing in the known universe, and we attach a body to it in a complex society, why should the answers be straightforward? Why aren't they dynamic? And why isn't it a change? So I think it really is, these are existential questions that we really should be having out in the open and not in the rancor of, I think you're doing it wrong, Doug, and how dare you, because, you know, I have the moral high ground, you know? Yeah. You're going to turn me off. And what we're going to do is we're going to continue to work the way we're working anyway within our scope of practice. And I'm happy to show you my results. And I keep inviting everyone to come to the gym and I'll show you the way we think and why we think that way.
Yeah.
I think if people just worried about themselves as individuals and everybody had that mindset, then the profession as a whole would be elevated. So, it's like the amount of time that some people spend being critical of, like, you know, the broken profession. It's like, you know, just improve yourself, show people what you do. And like, you can't always force this stuff. It's going to happen organically. So do a better job as an individual and show people what you do. And hopefully that elevates everyone collectively. I mean,
let me circle that again. Show me what you do. So Doug, you're at a lot of places I lecture and I see you and I always have to clean up your hot mess. Everyone's all confused, right? Well, I'm just kidding. A lot of the therapists I know, Danny, you just wrote a book about what's working for you and about ways that people can experience that model themselves. Write books. Don't just talk about your blog. And I need to see real video of how you move. And what I'll say is I understand I have a personal bias towards this because I have over 5,000 videos in the world showing how I think and what I do every day and exposing myself to the criticism, you know. And we get all these zombie arguments. There's no such thing as an adhesion. Well, if your skin doesn't slide over your calcanea or, you know, their fibular head or it's adhered to the tendon, and then I move it, and then your range of motion improves, and then your pain decreases by 8 points on the scale. What was that sticky spot? What do you call that? A extracellular matrix, dysfunction, disordered conjunction? I mean, so maybe you don't like certain words. I appreciate it. But if you're, like you say, if we're going to have standardization, if I can show you an outlier, then that standardization no longer works. So that standardization has got to be pretty robust and it has to account for all phenomenon, because if I can come in and show you a different model or an outlier in that thinking, in that process, then your standardization doesn't work anymore. And I think that's really important to understand, is that people are sufficiently complex and we actually need the creativity and the autonomy to help solve and manage a treatment inside the context of someone's real life.
Yeah. And here's the other thing I want people to also keep in mind, like, there's going to be a lot of physical therapists that listen to this and hopefully they'll form their own opinion on what they should or shouldn't be doing. But one thing that I want to at least be clear about is the fact that I feel like our profession has helped me significantly within my career. I feel like it's helped all of us. And this idea that physical therapy is broken is silly, right? Negative people find negative things in anything. You know, positive people with an abundance mindset find the positives in things and they expose that and they utilize it to their advantage. So, I know for me, I've met a lot of PTs that have gone to school or students that are in school because of, you know, Kelly's work in particular. And it's interesting to see them when they're there and they come and see us for maybe like a day in the clinic and they're frustrated because they're stuck in like a high volume clinic and they're like, should I have even gone to PT school? Like, it seems like, you know, it's not going the right direction. They come see us and they're like, oh shit, this is awesome. This is what I thought I was going to be doing. But then what they learn in school, maybe it's not exactly what they're going to do. And that's okay, because like you said, they're there to pass a test. But I want everybody listening to this to also understand that, like, I'm very positive on the profession of physical therapy. I think who else gets to work with badass people solving problems to help them have, you know, better lives without having to do things that are, you know, negative in terms of unnecessary surgeries or get addicted to medicine or avoid things for the rest of their life, right? Like, oh, you just can't run anymore. Like, dude, what if a dog chases you? What the fuck? You should be able to run away from a dog if you need to. So, you know, we get the opportunity to work with really, really amazing people and use our skill set to help change their lives for the better. And I think it's something that we should be very positive about, not negative, which I see too much of this in particular on social media, because it's easy to get a reaction. It's easy to get a lot of likes when you take a stance and be very negative on things. And Kelly, I think to your point, you know, for the amount of things that you've done for our profession, it's very easy for people to point their finger at you, to disagree with you in order to help build their own platform. And what's the phrase, heavy is the head that wears the crown? Like, when you put yourself out there and you've done so much, I think inherently you're going to get people that try to build themselves up by, you know, trying to bring you down in the process. So this idea that, you know, PT is going the wrong way and it's broken, I just don't see it that way. I think it's just a negative view that people take. That's just it's not accurate. So anyway, I want to look in there.
We're sending more people to physical therapy school than ever before because it's not broken. I'm like, hey, people really who want to be good coaches and help solve movement related issues, I'm like, you need to go to physio school. Like, if you want to know what, you know, what Doug can think or how we think or a way of thinking, I was a geography major at school, at college, and a geography major is a way of seeing the world. It's a way of understanding. It's, if you've ever read Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond, that's the same way I think about the body in its environment, right? It's not an accident that I came into that as a broken athlete, but also understanding that context matters to this. And, you know, to your point, Doug, just originally, you know, I am completely happy with the current model. I'm down, and I'm down to keep talking about how do we become more effective at our profession and move our profession into the limelight where it belongs. You're saying, Danny, exactly what you're doing. But if expert clinicianship was always a compromise between what you think is best for the patient and what the patient thinks best is for themselves, boy, you're going to lose your best practice from the start. And you, once again, you're at odds with yourself, because what you think is the best, based on the guidelines, the patient's like, I'm not doing that. Or I'm going to do it 10% of the time. I mean, what's adherence in physical therapy in the 30s? 27%, I think, you know? So, I mean, there are these big holes in our thinking all over the place. And if we're going to standardize or improve, then we're going to have to show our outcomes, all of them. We're going to have to own failed outcomes. And I don't think failed rehabilitation syndrome is something that some of the doctors have put at us, as saying that we don't have to ever accept responsibility for putting bad physical therapy through and then someone ultimately have surgery. So how do we wrap our heads around those things? And then more importantly, how do we continue to push positive on this? And I really, you know, there are a handful of therapists, and all the people that I name called and tagged out there, I follow for a reason, because they really help me clarify about why I believe what I believe. And I think that's really important. So even if you are out there as a physio and you're listening and you're like, man, I don't treat like that, you should be understanding, why does someone treat that way? What problems are they trying to solve? Because that is really the model that all the best coaches in the world for. We're going to put up, I'll tweet at it just in a second. If you haven't, I think, Doug, you might have already repurposed it. It came from Stuart McMillan, and it's this idea about clinical thinking. A little ebook came out of Altus, which is really what we need more of. Is we have so many tools, but not enough critical thinking. And I'll put that up, that ebook, or I'll even send you, and maybe you can put it in the show notes. And just as a reminder that people are solving the same sets of problems we are.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, for a broken profession, I would say it's afforded me some pretty incredible opportunities, and I'm happy with the career decision, and I don't feel limited or constrained by the professional choice that I made. And to come full circle, like, what originally started the standardization question on Twitter was somebody made the point that some of these more systemic macro level issues in healthcare are just way more important than the things that PTs fixate on, like whether it's cupping or dry needling or manual therapy. And somebody countered that and said, no, I think the cupping and the manual therapy and the dry needling, those are a big deal because they're not good. We should standardize the profession. But again, I think that these systemic things do really matter. And there's no perfect way to measure physical therapy outcomes. And again, you know, a lot of these are going to be driven by, well, do physical therapists determine how they should be gauged, or do health insurance companies? I think it should be the patient. So the more that the system incentivizes patients to look out for their own health, I think ultimately that might, you know, create a better answer than what we have now. Because I think the goal should be, for the same problem, whether it's low back pain, knee pain, the less money the patient spends of his or her own or of health insurance companies, the better. So it's not a perfect metric, but if we can get people to spend less money for the same thing, I think that's a good thing. And if we had a system that incentivized that type of behavior, I think it'd be better for everybody. So that's kind of my parting shot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, you're getting at the root of the problem with a lot of the ways that, you know, we get reimbursed or not reimbursed for certain things that, which is one of the reasons why this idea of a cash model or an out of network model or a fee for service model, whatever the hell you want to call it, is such an interesting sort of elegant solution to me and you, we're deciding, are you interested in doing this? If so, this is what it costs. We'll take these other people out of the equation and let's solve this problem together, right? No biases, nothing like that. It's basically
only outcomes. Only outcomes. Solutions. Yeah. I'll put my money where my mouth is. Fire me if you don't. Right.
Hey, guys, yeah, just, you can't do that.
I'm at 5% left on my computer. I feel like I can go on, but if I go away, I appreciate everyone so much, but I'll talk to the end.
Yeah, no, let's wrap it up so that you know, people can finish this in a commute there and, you know, to work and back, depending on, well, maybe it depends if you're in San Francisco or Atlanta traffic, it might be just one direction. Well, New York, just as bad. Never mind. All of us could probably do this in one trip. So, this is a fun talk. This is something that, you know, hopefully, you know, people can maybe need to listen to this more than once, you know, synthesize some of this information. I think these are like, this is some high level stuff. It's important conversations to have. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to have this conversation. When Kelly or Doug, you know, emails me or texts me and says, "Hey man, you want to talk about, you know, whatever," it could be anything. I'll say yes. Like literally anything. I'll say yes because I think they're very smart. They're incredibly passionate about our profession. And I think they've done nothing but really, really positive things for the profession of physical therapy and performance in general that are wrapped together within our profession. So, you know, for you guys that are listening to this, here's what you should really do. Get involved in the conversation. You know, go follow these guys on social media. Follow them, you know, on Twitter. Get involved in the conversation. See how you feel. Talk to your peers about this. Talk to your mentors about this and challenge what they're saying in particular, and not in a negative way, but just tell them, you know, hey, this is what I think about this, and this is the way I view this. These are the problems that I'm seeing, because you might be new to the profession, but it doesn't mean that you don't have ideas that are really positive and can help us. That's how it progresses. That's how we prove the new model. So anyway, I just want to say thanks so much for your time tonight, both you guys. I really appreciate it. I know you got a lot of stuff to do. Doug's busy treating everybody in New York City. Kelly's probably writing his whatever fifth, seventh book, whatever it is at this point, trying to raise two awesome daughters. You know, he got a lot of shit going on. So I appreciate it. And anytime you guys want to talk, we're totally down. And as for you guys that are listening to this podcast, thank you so much for listening. If you like it, let us know. If you don't like it, I don't fucking care, because I'll still do another podcast like this. It's my podcast. Do whatever the fuck I want. And if you haven't yet, go check out F Insurance or Fuck Insurance, I guess you can say it at this point. If you're interested in doing more of a patient to provider model and taking some of these things out of the equation that make us have to make bad decisions, just take them out of the equation and commit to your patients. And in order to do that, you got to be able to have a conversation with people, get them results, commit to it. Because if you're wrong, guess what? They still paid you. You know, and that's a tough place to be. So I think it makes us better. So anyway, guys, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And as always, guys, thanks for listening to the PT Entrepreneur Podcast. You want more cash PT biz help? If so, go get a copy of my book, Fuck Insurance. It's your playbook to successful performance PT practice and never having to deal with insurance again. You can get a free copy at finsurancebook.com. That's finsurancebook.com. Inside this book, you'll learn the direct techniques that we have used to become one of the fastest 100% cash PT practices in the country.